Hello and welcome to another podcast with me, Andrew Gray. I'm delighted I got yet another HR consultant with me. I'm tripping over myself these days with HR consultants. I'm delighted that this afternoon I have Ashley Healy from healyresourcing.co.uk. How are you doing, Ashley?
I'm very well, thank you, Andrew, on this fine Monday morning.
Fine Monday morning indeed. Let us get straight into it. Tell us all about who you are, what you do, and, you know, if you're any good. Why are you any good?
I'm brilliant. Who I am? I'm Ashley Healy. I work for myself. My business is called Healy Resourcing. I provide people management advice to employers and sometimes employees. In terms of background, I've been doing this about 3 years. I'd been
over... Well, you've been in the industry for donkeys, I think.
When I got my 30-year CIPD certificate, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. It was one of those, have I really been doing this for 30 years?
But CIPD, is that the Chartered Institute?
Chartered Institute of Personnel Development. It's our professional body that we're members of, and obviously they have different levels, so you can signify what level of competence or what level you've operated at in terms of HR, and because I'm old, I'm a fellow, so it means I've been around a bit and been involved in one or two interesting things.
I bet you have. I've been looking at your CV. It seems like you've worked for some major corporations in a very senior role. Tell us about those corporations as much as you can tell us.
Yeah, I mean, it's again quite varied. I suppose in terms of career highlights, Motorola down in Swindon was certainly one. Big American company. At that point, really at the forefront of a lot of HR type initiatives in terms of how people are managed, but also pioneers in Six Sigma quality control, and it was the first time I'd had that experience of that kind of culture, of a culture where you set targets, you're given KPIs, you're expected to meet them, but there was a very cooperative management culture, and teamwork was high on the agenda, and it was a really, really good place to work.
Sounds it. And how many people were you overseeing there?
Oh, wait. My role there was in the engineering department. They were basically developing base stations for mobile networks, and it was cutting edge technology. And there was a department of about 300 engineers,
wow.
And we were looking to recruit highly sought after, very technical software engineers, firmware, RF engineers, very, very quickly into this department. The site as a whole employed over 1,500 people at that point. And say I was looking after the engineering department and also the research, which had some very, very, very clever people in.
I bet it did. Probably some quite tricky people to manage, I suspect.
Very, very tricky people to manage, yes.
So other than Motorola, there's some other big names on
your
CV. Talk to me about them.
At Cytec, which was a global American chemical company based in Bradford. Originally, I was involved at the site in Bradford that employed around about 150 people, but within the company as a whole was around about 5,000. And at Bradford was involved in a big change program and introducing annualised hours and various other changes to terms and conditions with the trade union involved, which was again quite an interesting time. And later on I had a more European role, so I was looking after probably around about 2,000 people within Europe, including line management for the branch offices, because basically nobody else wanted to do it. I was line managing the offices in Milan and Madrid and Paris and Dusseldorf, and very nice it was too.
Hopefully you got to go on many a foreign jaunt.
Many a foreign trip, which is why I look like I do, Andrew.
Thank you for that. So it's 3 years ago you set up Healy Resourcing.
Yeah.
And as I said at the start, you were HR, so human resources.
Yes.
Explain to me quite what you do. What's the sort of typical client that you would have, and how would you help?
A typical client now would be smaller business, who often are not of a size where they can afford specific HR support within their business. So it's really advising them on anything to do with staff. So it's basically people management. So that's not just dealing with those difficult situations which crop up from time to time, but looking at policy development, what's best for them, but also training and recruitment and the best way of doing that within their particular business. So you have an accountant that might look after your finances and give advice and a good accountant will provide good financial advice, not just do the numbers. And same with the HR person, you know, people are probably the most important asset in any business. So look after your cash and look after your people and you'll have a successful business.
I couldn't agree more. On your blog, which has some absolutely fantastic titles and great articles in there, one of them is about making employees happy. Mm. Could you explain why you think that's so important? Expanding on what you've just said, please.
It's really important. And the first reaction many business owners, and not just business owners, in large companies do, is throw money at it. So if people, you throw money at a problem and then people will be happy. How many times in a business where somebody's handed in the notice and a company's made a counter offer, or we'll give you another $2,000 a year, and they said, okay, I'll stay only in 3 or 4 months' time to then leave again, because it's not the money that's driving them to leave, it's other things. So to make people happy, money's important, but it's not the be-all and end-all. For me, one of the most important things is set out those expectations. What do you want your staff to do? I just remember a conversation I had with a vet who had an issue with his practice manager, and conversation went on, and basically he says she wasn't doing what he wanted her to do, and basically said, well, have you told her? And he said no. So he came back about a week later and he says, brilliant, he went through a job description, told her what the expectations were, and she's really happy, surprisingly. She was just firing away in the dark. So laying those expectations out. So what do you expect your staff to do? When do you expect them to come in? Can they come in early and leave early? Even the little things. And the other thing is keep those communication channels open. Particularly in smaller businesses, the business owner is really passionate about and really cares about his business. The employees may not share the same level of enthusiasm. So you've got to get that enthusiasm over to your staff and get them to buy into your vision and to your dream, and keep those communication channels over. You talk to them. And if you do that on a regular basis and in a proper way, you'll pick up problems early, you'll pick up situations early, and you'll find out a lot more about your staff and what makes them tick. Once you find out what makes them tick, you can keep them happy.
That's utterly refreshing. Great that you said it. My experience, and it sounds like it's yours as well, is that when you have happy staff, of course they don't want to leave. Mm. And when staff do leave, it leaves a chasm. Mm. The cost of recruitment is so high, the cost of them leaving is so high. You should do mostly what you can within your reason, I think, to ensure that they stay.
Yeah.
In terms of cost. But the recruitment process is important, utterly essential. I see on your website that you specialise in psychometric testing and the recruitment process. Just explain to me, and to any of our listeners who may be from an employer perspective, why they should engage you or any psychometric testing in the recruitment process.
Yeah, any recruitment process is about gathering information. You want information about your prospective member of staff, and how they behave and operate at work is a key element of how they're going to perform at work, and also looking at what their basic ability is. So, what's the size of the engine? In a car term, so there are two tests that we can run. One is ability, so you run on numbers, on verbal, on words and how they deal with words, and also on logical reasoning. And from that, you can ascertain how big that engine is, and it's an element that is very stable. So that very rarely changes over time. So what you're dealing with, what's the trainability, have they got the right numbers or verbal skills for that particular job. And then you go on to the behavioural characteristics. So particularly if you're looking at leadership management positions, what kind of behaviours are you wanting to recruit into your particular business? And a psychometric test managed well with the right feedback can give you that information. Then you can build it onto what experience they've got, build it into competency-based questionnaires and interviewing, and to get that fuller picture that you need from employees, and rather than just an interview, which is all right, but if you look at much of the research, it's flawed. So the more information you get, the better decision you're going to get, and psychometrics are really, really good at that.
Following on from that, with a psychometric test, can you really pull out someone's values? Because my experiences as an employer and someone practicing employment law is when the values between the employer and the employee clash, there's going to be friction. When they are aligned, the employee will be there for inevitably for a long period of time. How can a psychometric test, if it can, pull out the values of the employee?
It can pull out, it depends on which instrument that you use. I'm licensed to use Talent Q, so so they have Dimensions, which looks at personality, so you can pull elements of behaviour in that, but they also have another instrument which really looks at motivations, and from that you can really pick out values. So it looks at what the hotspots are in terms of what really motivates them, and then you can really pick out the values from that instrument, and also that really helps you again know which buttons to press in order to, you know, keep them motivated and fully active within the business. And obviously you can line whether that aligns up with what your values are and the way you manage your business. So yes you can, but also there's good interview techniques will do that as well.
Great. Do you have any top tips for employers listening to this show as to how to manage the recruitment process or the ongoing relationship?
I suppose the best tip, and it's the one that should be the easiest, but it's the one that's left out, is really just talking to your staff. Just that open communication. Particularly a lot of bigger businesses that are very structured will have their annual appraisal, and that's sometimes the only time where a manager will actually talk to the staff, or they might do a 6-month review. You should be doing it on a much more regular basis. Doesn't have to be a set piece formal thing. Just open that communication, find out about, again, what I said before, what makes them tick. And keep that open communication, because if you've got that, if there are people are going through a difficult time in their lives, which does happen, they're more likely to open up to you, and if they do that, you're more able to manage that particular situation. There's been a lot in the press recently about mental health issues and well-being at work. If you have that open communication, you're going to pick up those problems and you're able to deal with them in a more supportive manner than if it came as a surprise, or people were hiding it and the issues were manifesting themselves in other ways through behaviours or through poor work performance or whatever it might be.
It's all very great advice. I suppose the difficulty I foresee is that some employers may be operating in quite a traditional way.
Yes.
And that the channels of communication aren't essentially open between employer and employee. And that you're right, you have that annual appraisal where it's a bit of a surprise to both parties as to what's going on. Any tips, though, for employers breaking the mould if they're in that traditional mindset of an annual appraisal? How do they change their way so that they are, if they can change their ways, talking to their employees on a daily, weekly basis?
Do away with the annual appraisal is the easiest thing. Just bin it.
I've pretty much done that here, actually. You should say that.
A lot of businesses, big ones, are doing that because it's just not doing what it's supposed to do. So bin it, but obviously you need an alternative in its place. And it could be regular one-to-ones. Just regular one-to-ones, we're going to schedule them in. It could be, you know, Friday morning is our one-to-one day, and it should be what's happening in your week, because everybody's really busy. What's happened? What's gone well? What hasn't gone well? And well, this is what we're going to be doing next week. So you can have very short-term conversations and how that fits into long-term goals. One of the things, certainly at when I was at SciTech, introduced in terms of that performance review program is, you know, why are people walking through the door every morning? What is their contribution to the bigger picture? So it's all right, you know, you've got your engineer beavering away, but how is what he or she's doing contributing to the site? And in SciTech's case, a big American global organization, and you can break it down. So, you know, what I do here does have an effect, on the performance of the business as a whole. And if they can see that, then again, it's that motivation. I'm actually making a difference. I'm actually contributing. I'm not just sat here doing my thing in isolation. It's actually part of a bigger picture. And the skill is translating that bigger picture down into the guy in the office or the lady in the office. Just and what their contribution is. And you can do it, but it, you know, it's not easy, but you can do it.
I haven't thought about this before, but it seems to me that part of your role is actually giving business advice, because this is actually quite, well, it's the most important thing that the businesses do.
Yeah.
And they're probably not getting it from their accountants, I'm guessing, or their bookkeepers. Essentially, it's you telling them some hard truths.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you must make a massive difference to the bottom line in due course.
You definitely. I mean, it might seem a bit trite, but that's the whole aim. That's the whole, you know, the aim is not to be, you know, nice and cuddly. Is to improve that bottom line, to make it a better business. So for the business owner, to make them a better business person and to make the business thrive. That's what you're trying to do at the end of the day. And sometimes and it depends on your relationship with that business owner. You have to hold the mirror up sometimes, and you know, some of the, particularly in those smaller businesses, some of the issues might be the business owner that has caused it. That can be difficult because, you know, they're paying you wages. They might not like what you're telling them.
So you just got to tell them now.
But if you've got to establish a relationship, so you do have that ability to. You can be a bit of a coach as well.
I can see that. Changing tack somewhat, in my experience of employment law, it seems to me that what trips up employers more than most things is disability discrimination. I think it's a fantastically complicated area of law, hugely important area of law, providing a great deal of protection, but it's massively, in my view, misunderstood. I know that you were involved in a hugely important case, Charlesworth versus Dransfield Engineering, which began, I think, in 2016 in a tribunal and was eventually went up after an appeal to the Employment Appeals Tribunal. As we found out actually about half an hour ago when we were preparing for this podcast, the barrister who I interviewed for my very first podcast, Mr. McNerney, was actually representing, I think, Mr. Charlesworth. Now, don't give us too much away about the case, but talk to us about disability discrimination and, if you can, a little bit about Charlesworth versus Dransfield Engineering.
Yes, I mean, this was interesting when I picked it up later on, but it was basically Mr. Charlesworth had cancer and had a kidney removed, and he was off work about 6 weeks. And during that 6 weeks, it was obvious to the business that they could operate quite happily with Mr. Charlesworth not being there.
And had to save some money, I understand.
And had to save some money. Now, had the decision been taken because the business realised that for the 6 weeks he was off, they could do without it, and that was the reason for the redundancy, because it was redundancy at the end, then it would have been disability discrimination under it could have been direct or under section 15. But the business argued successfully that it was a genuine redundancy because it needed to save money. It needed to save about 40 grand a year, which is Mr. Charlesworth's salary. And prior to him going off ill, there was a meeting with the site manager and the director owner of the business where this conversation took place. So the tribunal sort of decided it wasn't an unfair dismissal because the redundancy process was handled properly. It wasn't direct discrimination, and it wasn't a Section 15 indirect, because they accepted the evidence of the business that it were the reason for the redundancy was to save money and not because they could do without him. They realised that they could do without that particular post because he'd been off 6 weeks. At the EAT,
which is the Employment Appeals Tribunal.
Employment, thank you. the argument, Mr. McNerney, obviously was saying that it should have been a Section 15 because, you know, he was obviously had cancer, came under disability, and that was really the reason why he was made redundant, even if it was part of a genuine restructuring. He argued that would have been the case, but the judge didn't agree with him, thankfully, and agreed that, again, without being too technical, the real reason, even though they've been off 6 weeks with having his kidney removed because of cancer, was a factor, and it was maybe it might have been the major factor. The other factor in terms of why the decision was taken to make him redundant was a genuinely business reason and nothing to do with his disability. and basically the evidence turned on the what she said was what was in the employer's head at the time, and in the employer's head at the time was to save the 40 grand, and irrespective of whether he'd been off ill or not, that position was surplus to requirements, and the business could evidence that.
But as it may interrupt, as anyone listening to this will appreciate, it is hugely complicated.
It is hugely complicated.
And I was of the view that the claimant's case was highly likely to be successful. Clearly, with, I suppose, guidance from yourself, Ashley, and maybe solicitors involved as well, that the respondent employer walked away without any tribunal award against them. And it just shows, I suppose, the importance of great advice, but also how complicated it is for not only like employers, employees, but also the lawyers and the HR advisors.
Yes, very much so. I mean, Section 15, which is the indirect discrimination, wasn't an issue until the first tribunal, to the very beginning of the tribunal, when the judge decided that it was a potential runner. In the original claim, the claim was for direct discrimination and unfair dismissal. And on reading it, it's the judge who said, well, there potentially could be a Section 15, indirect discrimination. So it was the judge of the original tribunal who opened it up to Section 15. And that's obviously when, from the employer's side, we thought, this could be tricky, because it is a very, very complex piece of law, and evidence of that it actually went to the appeals tribunal. And I know they were considering appealing the appeals tribunal, but it didn't get accepted at a higher level.
Got it. And how does it feel to have helped create some of the British case law?
It was first time ever when he came and I thought, that's my case. It was great. So so I emailed everybody who would listen to me.
I bet you did.
Because I've never had that before.
Yeah, I can sense that, and it, I suppose, proves that lawyers and HR people can even disagree on a case, and that how the lawyers think perhaps a judge will go one way and they in fact goes another, and how unpredictable, therefore, litigation can be.
Yeah, I mean, that was very unpredictable. What we thought was a pretty solid case when we went to tribunal suddenly became unpredictable when the indirect discrimination was brought in by a tribunal judge. So, yes, I agree.
I bet. Now, I understand in the past you've worked with, or against, perhaps, trade unions. Do you have any advice for employers who have a unionised or partially unionised workforce? What should they do? Should they be beating the union around their head with a stick, or should they be kowtowing to everything that the union asks for?
Neither. My experience with working with, or any advice to businesses who've got trade unions involved, there is, don't be scared of them. They can make things a little bit more protracted. You have to go certain things. And again, it's about keeping those communication channels open. There's the set piece rituals. If you're doing the wage bargaining, they make a claim of a ridiculous amount, and the employer comes in with a counter offer of equally a ridiculously low amount, and through much discussion, they get to a figure. I've had experience of that. I've had experience of where the actual agreement figure is done behind closed doors, and then there's the actual negotiation is a piece of theatre, basically. So lots of shouting and jumping up and down till, but we both know what figure we're going to get to at the end of the day. So basically, you're performing for the full time official. He's performing for his shop stewards, and likewise for the management team. When it came to some of the more difficult reorganisations, experience just tells me that as much as you possibly can is to have that discussion with the trade union. It is very, very hard to impose. And when you do start getting heavy-handed and imposing things, then that's when you're going to get people's backs up. And it's not just at the time of that particular reorganisation. Once things settle down, people have very, very long memories. And when you try and do something again, it might be 2 or 3 years later, they will hark back to what happened before. All the mistakes that you've made will be brought up. If you had an aggressive attitude, then the resentment will still be there. So it can be difficult. I remember at Barrett Steel at the recession, the last, you know, a big turndown, we worked really hard to keep as many people as we could, but obviously we had to lose people, certainly in the Bradford warehouse, which was unionised, and the trade union came in and we went through exactly how we were going to select people. They told their members, just get on with it, they're doing things properly, you're going to have to suck it up, basically, which they didn't like, but that's the union was telling them. Later on, the managing director wanted to reduce the terms and conditions, particularly of the drivers. So we had to have another difficult conversation where we said, look, we want to basically pay you less money.
Never goes down very well.
Which never goes down very well. But because historically we'd handled things properly, we were able to have at least a discussion. We never really got to an agreement because there's no trade union who was going to accept a permanent cut in wages. They'd already accepted a temporary one, which had been restored, but a permanent change in the terms and conditions, which would make them worse off. You know, trade union ain't, they're just not going to do that. So we actually went through the dismissal and re-engage on new terms, which is, again, the last resort.
Yes.
Thing, because they were never going to agree to it. And there was a lot of huffing and puffing, and ACAS got involved and said, look, we have to do it for these reasons, and we've explored every other option, and everybody signed up. But I think had we not had a good relationship before, it could have gone a different way, and
sure,
you know, we could have had walkouts and God knows what.
Ashley, thank you very much. Your words today are words of wisdom. They are sage. I hope people listen. I hope employers take action. Most of the things that you're saying are really quite basic, but I really don't think many employers are doing it. It's very sad, and therefore, as you say, perhaps causes much more resentment in the workplace and therefore lower productivity, and nobody's happy in such a situation. How can listeners to this podcast find out more about you?
They can go onto my website, which is www.healeyresourcing.co.uk. Or which is probably the best way, and all my contact details are actually on the website.
Super, thank you very much, Ashley, and very grateful for your time.
Cheers, thank you, Andrew.